Hello and welcome to Insight. Today I'm joined by Matthew Errett, Senior Fellow at the American University in Moscow, Editor-in-Chief of the Canadian Patriot Review and co-founder of the Rising Tide Foundation, by Isa Blumi from the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University, and by Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist and regular UK column contributor. Welcome everybody to the program. It's a delight to have you here. Today we're going to be talking about China and China's influence in Africa and the Middle East in particular. So where do we start? China obviously over the last lot of years has been developing its interests in the Horn of Africa, in the Middle East, particularly as part of the Belt and Road Project. So I'd like to maybe begin by just asking each of you, if we begin with Matt and then with Isa in particular, I'd like to get your perspective on as a sort of baseline for where you think or what you think China is doing in this region. So Matt first, if we could start with you.
Sure, yeah. Well, I think that the famous anecdote between Henry Kissinger and Zhou Enlai is always a good one. Kissinger being somebody who had brought online a new type of foreign policy for the U.S. in terms of how foreign aid would be determined, especially towards poor countries that were outlined in his NSSM 200 report in 1974 that was declassified almost 20 years later, which outlined, 14 aspiring countries that wish within the global south to have industrial modern technology and industry, which can no longer be permitted to have those wishes obeyed, and that the United States must instead enforce a policy of zero technological growth, or at the very least, negative population growth in some fashion or another. And he outlines in this document the idea that the resources under the soil of many of these countries, Ethiopia, Mexico, many Asian countries are on the list, Egypt, they're in the strategic interests of the United States. And if they did develop their industrial capacity and stood on their own 2 feet, then the US would be less secure within the context of the Cold War. And thus that could never be permitted. Now Kissinger had an experience with Zhou Enlai early on when he asked about Zhou Enlai's considerations or thoughts of the French Revolution. And Zhou Enlai said, it's a little bit too early to tell. And Kissinger prided himself on having a long wave of history. And it's true, compared to your average technocrat, he does take a long wave. He's one of those types who recognizes that things that happened in like 1648 with the Peace of Westphalia still have an impact on what's going on today, which is true. And most people don't appreciate these things, but he was startled that Zhou Enlai took a much longer approach to the waves of history. And by saying it's too soon to tell, he was startled. Because there's, I think, something in the Chinese philosophy that Zhou Enlai was tapping into or expressing that does take a deep, deep view of the long waves of history, thousands of years into the past and into the future, into their considerations, which is very rare for the Western, average Western technocrat to think in terms of, or especially your average member of the citizenry. So I think, today China in Africa is doing something which I think ties into a very, very long-term strategy for humanity as a whole, which runs contrary to the sort of system of stasis and negative population growth that had been encouraged by the Anglo-American establishment for many decades. And I think that they're trying their best to provide a new way of doing business that is much more premised upon emitting long-term credit for actual tangible, creations of infrastructure, soft and hard alike, as well as educational programs in many of the countries that they're doing business with. Despite the fact that there are imperfections, and I think we're going to talk about some of those imperfections today in terms of the missteps or the choices made along the way within a context of a very rigged and dishonest global game that they're operating within. But I think it is overall a very different paradigm, what we've seen regarding China's approach to African investments and security more broadly than the sort of thing that had been keeping that country underwater for generations.
Okay, thank you for that. Isa, is this something that you would agree with?
Unfortunately not. I see China being much more of a nefarious partner in this continued transformation of the global economy. which, as I noted in my work on Yemen, there have been pockets of resistance that have been impervious to other means of coercion, pressure, the kind of traditional methods after Bretton Woods system was established that would allow for, let's say, profitable exploitative relations to move forward in the global south that had had a momentary burst of independence or seeking independence from the kind of more traditional forms of direct imperial oversight and extraction of raw materials from Africa, from the Middle East and elsewhere. China of 1950s, when they made its first forays into Middle East via North Yemen, where the imamate was the first to recognize the newly established Communist Party as the sovereign over China and actually formed diplomatic relations for the first time, is a very different China than the one that evolved since Kissinger made overtures in the 70s. We know that from China itself, the massive movement of population from the countryside to urban areas, many which had to be built from the ground up, modeling in many ways the kinds of urban development that we see in parts of the Middle East ongoing today, and the desperate need for raw materials, which the markets which offer those raw materials, while profitable for those who are engaged in them, could actually be contradictory to the objectives of China's capacity to redesign itself, especially during this hyper period of urbanization and development in the 1990s onward. And unfortunately, countries throughout the global south have been made available to avail their resources, their human as well as natural resources, to this process, which again have been, corresponds with significant the movement of industrial capacity from Europe and United States to China, where much of our gadgets, from telecommunications to with other things that we are consuming in large amounts in the larger world, are often in very exploitative conditions, actually manufactured still in China. And the very fact that some of these regions that China, through its Beltway initiatives, have gained access to, these were areas that either were traditionally unavailable to global markets for exploitation or were deemed to be too costly. And why not allow for Chinese credit to make available and provide the financing needed to actually access these regions that, until the mid-1970s, were still in Portuguese hands or in the throes of war with counter-revolutionary forces, speaking of Angola or Mozambique, for example, and in many ways what happened to Yemen, as it also became a target for opportunistic investment, where the reference to an old China, a revolutionary China that supported revolutionary movements, is a paper reference these days. There's actually no practical support for those societies who are still in the throes of resisting globalism and globalization. China has been integrated into the global economy. It's a major player in it. And its initiatives have in many ways provided a parallel engine for continued integration of regions of the world that had until then been outside reach of financed capitalism, of exploitation of nature, and more importantly, exploitation of human resources. So unfortunately for Yemen, for Eastern Congo, for Mozambique, especially in the north, Angola, where I was just this summer, these are societies that over the last, since the late 1990s, have suffered significant levels of exploitation and loss of sovereignty and the pillaging of their resources with very little to see as a result, despite the infrastructure that was developed. This infrastructure was developed to provide access to these resources. That's my rather long-winded take at this initial foray.
I guess I have a bit of a question in terms of the rectification of some of the terms that we're using: capitalism, revolutionary activity, like revolution as a term, imperialism. Do we see, Issa, all definitions of capitalism as being equal, or like are they? Is it all sort of like that? That Charles Dickens, you know, industrial exploitation of the masses, is that all, the only expression of it, or is there any positive expressions of capitalism or variance, or is it all different degrees of that in your mind?
Well, the indigenous circuits of commerce that have pre-existed European industrialization certainly suggest that there are certainly other ways of, let's say, incorporating credits and finance to engage in investing in projects that would lead to shared profit making as well as shared risk, which is something that's fundamentally changed in the last 200 years, where the burden of risk taking is applied entirely on working class or those whose resources are targeted for exploitation. And therefore, the let's say the fair price paid for those resources and the long-term costs of allowing those resources to be plundered. And I use that term very purposely. The plunder dynamic is certainly at play in the last 200 years of industrialization and the rapid project of seeking raw materials to service that. But that has also extends to the ability of peoples in the way of this process of actually resisting it, plundering their resources as a strategy to undermine their ability to sustain themselves and resist. And that seems to be regularly played out until today, even with Chinese projects that, again, on paper seem to be operating in different terms, but the results are often quite the same.
So just quick follow-up. Would you say that the intention of of both of this form of plunder capitalism, plundering of resources of people, is to primarily weaken the sovereignty of the individual people living within a nation and the nation as a whole to make them weaker and thus more malleable to a stronger power always? That's the underlying agenda or objective?
Well, it's to strengthen the capacity of the state to enforce laws that service the interests of those who are partners in this process. A political elite who benefit from mobilizing the state's ability to, when necessary, violently suppress farmers, for instance, who would more or less love to be left alone and who are now induced to settling in cities and availing their labor just to find ways to feed themselves. A process, again, which has played itself out in Europe in the 19th century. In the Middle East as well, or in the middle of the 19th century, in many parts of Africa, much later. Still today, we're seeing this happening. And China saw this in a massive way from the 1950s onwards. The Great Leap Forward, of course, was one of those initial steps. But I think this urbanization process that led to such a significant proportion of China's population to move from the countryside to the cities, it follows this model where beneficiaries are at a real level, those who are shareholders in whatever you want to call them, associated with the state capitalist enterprises, or those who are funding them from Shanghai, Hong Kong markets, and who are integrated into City of London and Wall Street circuits of capital. So everyone's involved in the Chinese economy, benefited and profited handsomely. China's involvement in the global economy as a creditor, building infrastructure, securing access to, again, forests of northern Mozambique or cobalt in eastern Congo, Angola's oil, often on scales of profit margins that are significantly better than if IMF came in and secured a contract for GE or Bechtel to build infrastructure in the past. Again, many Chinese operations are done on very cheap labor conditions, often by contract. In Angola, apparently prisoners were sent to go and build hospitals and bridges, which are now crumbling because of this poor quality. There's a lot of things to point at that seem to be replicating some of the worst and most egregious forms of exploitative profit-taking that we have seen in the last 200 years in the world. And it's just simply moved itself and became incredibly lucrative in this period from the 80s onwards in China. And now that accumulated savings of profits or people's ability to borrow in order to try to buy a home or invest in stock shares in stock markets has now been recirculated to help build and integrate parts of Africa into the global economy.
Do you think that metrics involving things like average quality of life, longevity, infant mortality, hours of productivity per capita, or things of that sort, have improved in any way over the years that China has approached economics within its own country and outside? Or have those metrics generally been negative, as we've seen with the IMF World Bank effects of their economic policies to poor countries or even to their own populations internally over the past 50, 60 years?
Well, for people in Yemen,
I'm just curious if you see a qualitative difference in any way, or do you really just see these globalized, you know, Western neoliberal globalization in what China has done as being the same thing as I feel like you do? Like, are there any qualitative differences that you see? Or...
Well, I wouldn't qualify what's happening as Western per se. I think it's an evolution of a mechanism of exploitation and extraction of wealth and subordinating people's ability to resist that. And again, Yemen, which was supposedly a backward country, shows a resilience that frustrates these various enterprises. In the meantime, China, without any solidarity, without any sense of irony, sends big tanker ships to take Yemeni oil at $30 below market value as we speak. Now they're being forewarned by the resistance in the north, who are saying that we will use drones to destroy your ships. We refuse to allow this to happen anymore. But similarly, in northern Mozambique, some could argue that the outburst of violence in Cabo Delgado is an indigenous response to the plundering of their forests and the infrastructure that was being built to connect Central Africa with the coast of northern Mozambique, where there's also tons of oil and gas waiting to be exploited. Their lives haven't improved. You go to Luanda and the lives of the people whose lives have been uprooted. Yes, civil war was a disaster and that was a perfect window of opportunity to slide in at a time when there was seemingly solidarity from the progressive world like China. They proved themselves to be wolves in sheep's clothing, as many people were telling me. Luanda is a horrible place to live if you don't have the resources, if you don't have friends in Dos Santos kind of circles. It's one of the most expensive cities to live in, yet it's one of the places where you find people living on literally nothing and begging all the time in a very violent place. So no, their lives have not improved. The lives of Yemenis, the lives of Syrians, the lives of Libyans, who are all in many ways stuck in a system that where Chinese complicity is very much evident in the form of the UN votes, the fact that China doesn't send weapons to peoples resisting exploitative forces anymore. They used to in the 50s, in the early 60s, but that has changed. And China is facilitating.
I was just going to say they're sending weapons to the Saudi coalition to drones, effectively. But what is interesting for me is that, and maybe Matt, I almost feel, and Mike, you asked this question of me at one point. Is it governmental policy that's pushing this, or is it individual corporations? Is China centrally ruled, or is it fragmented into different power structures, some of which may be pushing a different agenda to another? I mean, it's such a vast country. That's one thing, one question. And the other thing which kind of does fascinate me is, for example, in Syria, really and truly, the only help that China has given in comparison to, for example, Russia is the veto, right? And that was very early on in 2012, 2013. They kind of stood down on the debt that Syria owed to them, but then so did Russia, actually, far sooner. Matt, I sent you that recent report on that from 2005, where Russia effectively cancelled, I think it was $13 billion of debt to Syria. China has backed off, but it hasn't, as far as I'm aware. I've been looking through the various paperwork that I have. It's not cancelled that debt. So, and at the same time, Syria, of course, is instrumental to the Five Seas project, to the Belt and Road Initiative. It has resources. It's the doorway to Eurasia. That's why the battles are being fought here and have been fought here for 75 years. So I'm a little bit foot in both camps. I totally agree with Issa. I'm shocked by the way China is really exploiting the situation in Yemen and effectively supporting the Saudi, US, Israeli, UAE coalition. This for me is kind of, it's a big disappointment for me in my trying to understand where Russia is somewhat clearer. I see Russia as kind of a lot more black and white. And existentially, I can kind of agree with many of Russia's arguments and many of Russia's actions here in Syria. I can categorically say Russia has respected the sovereignty of Damascus despite its considerable footprint here, both militarily and economically. So I don't know how many questions were kind of involved in that. That was a bit of a ramble.
No, it wasn't. It was quite useful, Vanessa. But Matt, you've asked Issa quite a number of questions there, and I get the impression from those questions that you don't agree with his position on that. So, how do you feel about what both Vanessa and Issa have said?
No, I mean it's very, very, very important points have been raised by both good people. The way I'm looking at the situation that we're living through right now is that we're at a global, once in many dozens of lifetimes systemic situation of transformation. And I think that the upper level grand strategists within Eurasia, especially, but also within the West, are looking at this with different eyes. The system that has taken us to this crisis is not, you know, a lot of people in the West who are afraid about a lot of the uncertainty and instability that they're going into want to go back to normal. They just want to go turn back the clock a few years when they had a job, you know, when things were, when they could think about the future and they believed that they could have a pension and these things that wouldn't evaporate in a banking collapse or some sort of a military conflict that could go nuclear. There's so many points of turbulence, right, that could trigger the whole systemic breakdown. And they're not disconnected. The way I see it is that the thing that was put online by Kissinger, and I tend to look at things, and maybe Issa doesn't, I don't know, from a conspiratorial standpoint with longer waves. That's why I sort of alluded to that little dialogue between Kissinger and Zhou Enlai. Because I do see Kissinger as part of a process that he was brought into to carry out a transformation of a once relatively viable economy that had some merit in the West into a post-industrial consumer cult, which was initiated with, you know, his work with George Shultz and the different Trilateral Commission members in the early 70s, a big new being a member of Volcker, David Rockefeller being a big player in severing the dollar from the, you know, the gold reserve in floating the dollar was not just that mechanical act, but rather something that was needed in order to bring about a broader system of global relationships of dependency, which Kissinger, you know, again, his NSSM 200 report is very clear on what that type of dependency is in terms of creating a society that would be much more crystallized around a first world, you know, consumer society that would no longer need to have industries or dirty factories, and we could just consume and make ideas. And the darker people of the second and third world would be the slave labor zones of providing, you know, cheap goods that we used to make ourselves at higher quality. We might give them enough just to stay alive, but not enough to actually buy the products that they produced. And then you'd have Africa at the bottom of the barrel that wouldn't even be allowed to have sweatshops. They would just be there to have their resources extracted, as Kissinger oversaw in so many ways in those dark years. So, I mean, I see it from the standpoint that that system that was brought online, which involved, you know, markets determining people's relative desires on speculative markets of futures and spot markets, determining the values of what commodities would be, what the dollar would be tied to, you know, petrol and other things, which had no bearing on physical reality, which it used to in the 50s and the 60s. There was more of a sense that the monetary system's behavior had to in some way reflect activity in the real world. That increasingly was detached. And I think that that was done as a bubble economy by design, and bubbles pop. And I think that every time that this has ever been done in my analysis of history, going back to the South Sea bubble and the tulip bubble, I mean, there's a science to this thing. Every time this sort of process was, or when nations were dumb enough to accept this type of policy, the consequence was always wealth transfer within the target nations that did it, the moving of wealth into the hands of a small coterie, and the weakening of the nation's ability to direct its own destiny, according to an international financier system above the nation state in question, or nation states plural. And a pop, a blowout would always happen. Tulip, South Sea, many of the panics of the 19th century always were the result, and economic warfare. So, I mean, I think that was always sort of the design, was to create a system that would not be able to be brought back to normal. And we are not going to go back to a system that will look anything. We couldn't go to a system, I don't think, that looks anything like what has been driving us into a certain direction for 40 plus years. I think it's designed to collapse. I think that those who position themselves, especially after 1991, 92, celebrating, you know, the New World Order, blah, 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 Joe Biden, how I learned to stop worrying and love the New World Order. you know, I think that they were really celebrating the end of history and the idea that finally they won humanity. They like won the game. And I think these people kind of think of it that way. And again, it's conspiratorial, and some people might attack me for taking a conspiratorial approach to it, but I don't care. But I think that what has emerged from this script over the past, especially 10, 12 years, I don't see as it, well, by that I'm referring to the Russia-China relationship and the Eurasian, basically those countries being encircled and targeted by U.S. full spectrum dominance that have been sanctioned, attacked. I think that Russia, China, and many of their allies in Eurasia are trying to not only break away from the script that they were expected to follow in a controlled demolition, but I think they are working hard to try to slowly undo a lot of the rules of the rigged game. And it's not easy because they didn't create those rules, but they're operating within a very hostile environment that wants to undermine any opposition to this unipolar hegemonic ideology that wants to come out on top in this, you know, post-collapse era, where I think that they're trying to put out fires, but it's slow going, and I think they're trying to win over power blocks, especially in the Gulf states. I think that's a big part of, if you could break away the Gulf states that have historically been largely instruments for the Western financier oligarchy, carrying out the funding of Wahhabism, of all sorts of various nefarious activities around the world, I think that would be a really good thing for them in the longer run, even though you're dealing with, you know, shallow actors who have very, perhaps in many cases, lowly motives, but they don't want to be, I think they don't want to be flushed either. And I last thing I'll say, and then I know I've been ranting. I think that in the post-Great Reset age, the hydrocarbon economy plays no role ultimately in this decarbonization of the world system. And I think ultimately countries that are reliant on hydrocarbon production for their survival, as the Gulf states are, especially Saudi Arabia, are not going to play as much of a role as they used to under the globalization era. And I think they're looking for survival. I think if China can also harmonize the Iran-Saudi Arabia relationship, as I think they've been trying to do, I think that they could create a climate whereby a lot of these other unjust situations in Yemen, in Syria, and in Africa can slowly become resolved in time. But I don't think it could happen very quickly. But I think that they're playing for humanity right now. Like, I think it's a question of something is going to come out on top out of the collapse of the current system, and whether it's going to be something based upon a death cult pushing for the reduction of world populations under a world system of stasis, or whether it's going to be something that's viable based on cooperation and development, I don't think they can coexist there for much longer.
Vanessa, did that answer your question?
Some of it. I'd be interested to know what both think China's view of humanity as a whole is. What is their... because Russia, I think, is very clear. I think I don't see Russia as some kind of white savior. I don't see any power base as a white savior. But what I do see Russia as is a realist who, one, they have a history of a huge amount of suffering and loss of life in their own nation. For them, war is something that I believe they would avoid. People I'm talking about, ideologically speaking, at all costs. I think realistically speaking, Russia knows that to survive, they need humanity. And so for that reason, they're not going to throw all of humanity under the bus, which the West appears to be perfectly well inclined to do. But I don't really, me personally, I don't have a handle on what China's, you know, what their empathy is with humanity, how they feel towards humanity. I don't have that experience. So I'd be really interested in what both of your views are from that perspective. Lisa, maybe.
There was a lot said. Maybe not to go back, start from the end, I guess. My concern is that I'm going to use the term oligarchs. I think that's it could apply to those who are the main beneficiaries of this concentration of power in China. They certainly do not represent the bulk of this billion plus people, most of whom are now living under severe forms of austerity induced and sometimes in very draconian ways through a system of public health enforcement that in the case of the far west, the Turkmen areas, they've endured I was in Kashgar in 1990, and I've seen pictures of what has happened to Kashgar and Urumqi since this period. The indigenous population have become significant minorities in their own homelands, and they are living under sometimes very severe oppression. And the harnessing of this Islamophobia that came with the Bush generation in China itself suggested already that there were far more in common amongst certain elite classes in Beijing and Shanghai with those in Hong Kong, London, and New York than with working people who are going to factory every day and working very long hours and dreaming of owning their ideal two-bedroom apartment in some high-rise, many of whom are now been through this Ponzi scheme screwed of their life savings and actively trying to either by protest of not paying their mortgages, again, their homes have not arrived. They haven't been built. By the way, a model of scamming investors that took place in Albania, I know very, very well, in 1997, which resulted in street violence that unleashed for a couple of weeks a real scare in parts of Europe. Now, that is certainly a model for which you draw and contingency plans to avoid moving forward. That's my concerns with what happened with, for instance, outbreaks of bread riots, combination with middle class losing everything in stock market crashes in Egypt, for instance. There were very effective infiltration of potential revolutionary moments to actually steer this energy in a direction that was much more manageable, in introducing an Ikhwani government that placated certain elements who could very easily have joined in solidarity with, let's say, more secular youth movements in Egypt. They didn't succeed in Syria, but it did succeed in Yemen for a brief moment of also robbing the people of their revolution. And that the result, the retort, has been one of enduring war in which China has proven to be a perfect partner in the process. In the larger environment of the Horn of Africa, China has, alongside many other European and even Japanese, have established military bases in Djibouti, have been partnering with these very dubious regimes in helping plundering the resources of Africa, creating market relationships that will assure that these projects are profitable, regardless of what happens again to the human beings who live in these regions. The environmental destruction, the destruction of livelihoods, of tradition, all for the future success of China, so they could save which humanity, which generation? I don't quite understand that. I don't see that as a viable argument for us to accept and embrace that, well, we will sacrifice our dignity in our existence today for a theoretical future-empowered monolithic Chinese Communist Party that will lead humanity to victory against an enemy they seem to be in bed with at the moment. So I don't think the credentials of those who have profited from exploiting first and foremost Chinese peasants turned into factory workers, to now becoming major players in global supply chain management, to sequestering very cheaply raw materials by corrupting a political class that have proven over and over again to have no interest in their own population's well-being, is not a body of work, if you will, of a revolutionary people, of a people with solidarity for the peoples of the rest of the world. I think if there are any elements left in Xi and others of the Communist Party of the, let's say, some would argue legitimate and sincere outreach and emphasis of solidarity out of necessity, perhaps, in China in the 50s and 60s, as they were facing the throes of counter-revolutionary forces and threats of invasion. But again, the records tell us a very different story. It's a very brutal process of Chinese integration into the global economy. First and foremost, on peoples who live in the compounds of the confines of this Chinese state, which has been very aggressively expansionist at the expense of peoples of Tibet, of peoples of the Uyghur of the East, and the Hui Muslim populations, and those in Yunnan province. And the China has been willing to wage war on Vietnam in the 80s, and willing to conduct and invest in development projects that are as abusive and destructive as those that were promoted in the 50s and 60s by UN, IMF, and no longer Bechtel and GE as exclusive beneficiaries, but Costco and others who have shareholders who are making a lot of money sitting in New York and London. So So China's integrated into the global economy. Investors have profited from China's massive urbanization, its industrialization. Yes, the West has abandoned industry pollution from industrial production. Germany is one of the last countries that are going to see this process where their factories are going to finally move to third world countries or cheaper areas of production in Eastern Europe. But again, doesn't necessarily mean that those who are the ones who will be cooperating in this process are holding their nose to it. The political and economic classes who have benefited from integrating China into the global transformative, constantly transforming system that we refer to it as a system, are not our friends. They're not our allies. They've demonstrated that in very explicit ways. And the very fact that they cooperate far more than they actually prove to be confrontational around the world with the very same actors that we would all agree seem to be on the surface, the poster child of the emblematic examples of evil. It's for me one of the important factors that makes me very emphatic in this respect. I don't believe in that the nation state operates in those terms anymore. I think we have political classes who share common interests despite the fact that they are from different countries. I don't see countries operating and political elites in those countries who are operating in these countries understanding their place in the world as those protecting the sovereign interests and the interests of their own constituencies. They service a very different group of interests. And the contradiction is very evident to the people on the ground. We live through it. Western Europe is going to be going through a period of austerity now that I would hope finally some people would open their eyes and realize that what has happened over the last 20, 30 years of Europe's integration with power increasingly in the hands of those unelected people in Brussels who represent a wide range of industrial financial interests. They're more than willing to sacrifice the livelihoods of their own citizens. And that certainly applies for powerful interests in Russia and China and Yemen and Congo, Angola, let alone UK and the United States, which is, I think, is quite obvious.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly there have been a lot of things to complain about. Evergrande, the property bubble, great example of that. Injustices on a variety of levels. I mean, when I look at things like, the abuses of their the economic tricksters who managed one of these insane property bubble scams of Evergrande. We have all sorts of analogies to similar activity and scams on a similar scale, if not worse, in those forces in the West. I just look at how people like Xi Jinping responded to that compared to his counterparts in leadership positions of the West. In which involved something that was actually, real. Like he didn't just bail out Evergrande the way a lot of people screaming in the West said he should have. He basically told, those responsible that they're going to have to both pay out of their own pockets. And he started cracking down on speculation in housing. So it does seem like there is a bit of a mess there that is actually being at the very least recognized and in some measure addressed, whereas I haven't seen anything analogous to that in the West. The question then also is like, well, are they setting the rules of the game? I mean, the current Chinese policy, which emerged out of Xi Jinping, is relatively a young policy from 2012-13, which seems to be, I'm seeing a lot of evidence of an effort to take a dance that has already been underway and a lot of momentum in that dance. And by that, I'm talking about the system of rules that have moved. I mean, humanity is in process, right? We're not a fixed static thing. There's a process that's moving us in certain trajectories based upon certain rules we've agreed to, despite the fact that some of these rules, maybe most of those rules are fallacious. So it seems to me that there has been an effort to take a process that they didn't create and transform it in ways that are actually in opposition to the interests of those who wish to try to come out on top of this, you know, we alluded to this Great Reset, one world government, whatever it is, post-nation state, system of technocratic controls, neo-feudalism, I don't know what you want to call it. But they're trying to do things that are contradicting that other operating system that we all know and hate. And I see that from a variety of levels. I see it from the standpoint of, I mentioned the overcoming of the limits to growth, the increase of longevity of productive powers, but also of other metrics too, including it within Xinjiang and within Tibet. I mean, the average life expectancy and overall population quality and quantitatively has increased. And I haven't seen evidence that you've said that their native indigenous traditions have been wiped out under some concretized or some concrete monolith of the CPC org. I don't see it. I look at a lot of videos and interviews of people living in these regions. I've been following the projects for, you know, cultural community centers, artistic centers, as well as advanced technology that these people have access to that integrate them with the broader society that they are parts of. High-speed rail in Tibet and Xinjiang being built and things of that sort. We don't have anything of the sort in the West. That's different. And I would say also the question of the mind power. Like, it seems like China currently, when I look at their approach to training and providing technical training and actual schools to produce engineers in other countries that they do business with is nearly boundless. Every country I'm looking at different lists of all of the schools and training centers. And I know China is criticized for bringing in their own staff and their own workers to build projects, but they're going into countries that have been abused by generations of imperial policy, which don't have the technical expertise to do a lot of the things themselves. But the difference between China and the West is that where the West would just, I could see the effects of billions, maybe trillions probably, of dollars of US aid and World Bank lending and things that has only created more poverty, more squalor, less education per capita, less technical proficiency, because we go in with conditionality saying, okay, we want those resources, we'll build enough infrastructure just to extract, provide nothing for the people, maybe give some money for the encrusted, Western trained elite that are going to be our auxiliaries locally managing the slave colony. But China's created, I mean, you could see this for the past 15, 20 years. I mean, tens and tens of thousands of highly trained engineers in every country that they're doing business with as much as possible. But the problem too that I see is that a lot of the countries that they're doing business with are messes, but not because of the country themselves. It's because they've been influenced and manipulated by Western social engineers who have created conscious messes and to better manipulate Mozambique, Angola, Rwanda, Kenya. But I look at Kenya, I look at Ethiopia, I look at these countries, and it's like China is actually training people to do it themselves over time. It just takes time, and they're building infrastructure that we never permitted because we don't want these countries to have the ability to have any type of say economically in their own affairs. And I do think that these countries like Ethiopia, which has the Addis Ababa Djibouti Railway, which is going to extend if the world's not lit on fire, if that country's not overturned by Western manipulated insurgency groups, which they've been doing not just in Syria, it's been in Ethiopia with the Tigray, which is directly tied to the US State Department. They're using these as proxies to destabilize the entire region because they don't like the Grand Renaissance Dam. They don't like the development projects. And that China signed a military agreement with Ethiopia to defend BRI projects makes sense because these projects have been targeted by those who don't want it to happen. And Ursula von der Leyen and others have said they don't approve of the way China builds infrastructure in Africa. They don't approve of that. They want green energy and solar panels only, maybe little mini local projects with microcredit so you know people could paint rocks for Western dollaramas. But they don't like anything that actually transforms the nation's power ability to supply its people the energy resources needed to overcome mass infant mortality and actually have a better way. So I mean, it would be nice if we could like have every indigenous tribal group have their choice of historic lifestyles remain untouched by great powers, but I just don't see how in the real world that could really happen in a total way. I think you can respect their traditions and encourage and enrich their local traditions and languages and stuff. But to say that it could happen without being influenced or polluted by technological growth or things of that sort, I don't think that could happen. And...
Right. Now, look, we've been speaking for 55 minutes, and this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. But I have to say, it has actually, rather than answering questions, only increased the number of questions that I have. So I just want to end, Matt, with you first. Because, you know, some of the things that Issa was saying there, I resonate with me. But equally, a lot of the things that you've just been saying resonate with me as well. So I'm not really any clearer in my own mind, actually, where I stand on this. But, Matt, the Issa was suggesting that China has been is being quite hard on its own population in many, many ways. And one of the things that I think needs to be addressed in some way is the whole COVID zero policy that they are continuing to pursue at the moment, which it seems to be having a really detrimental effect on China's ability to internally to produce product, but for people to have jobs and livelihoods and so on. It's actually affecting them in a very negative way. So I'd like you to discuss that just very briefly, if we could. And Issa, following that, then I do want to come back to this issue of the fact that China has forgiven loans in Africa. I mean, I just looked it up here, so it's actually 23 loans, 17 countries. And in fact, what I hadn't appreciated was that those were interest-free loans in the first place. I'd be interested to get your thoughts about that. So Matt, first on COVID zero.
Well, without actually being on the inside of a lot of these internal policy discussions within China's governing class, I have to speculate a bit using, I'm going to offer some what I think are informed speculations. I don't have all the answers. I do think that some of the imagery and the framing of videos out of context and things that we're often being given by much of the Western press to try to paint this demonic picture that life is hell on earth for all the Chinese people who are living in a slave colony, I think that that's dishonest. I don't think it's that bad. But the zero COVID thing is, I don't approve of that personally. I don't fully understand it. What I could say is that China, I do know for a fact, has been looking very seriously for many, many years at the growth of the U.S. bioterror apparatus internationally that is tied to the Pentagon with, I thought it was maybe dozens a couple of years ago. I thought if you asked me, I would have said maybe, what, a few dozen international bio labs have been working on ethnically targeted pathogens, as has been outlined directly by the Project for New American Century, September 2000 RAD, Rebuilding American Defenses document, co-authored by Wolfowitz, Donald Kagan, a variety of these creepy, creepy characters. But they put it all out there, basically outlining, you know, that the existential threat for this new American century would be the possible rise of Russia, China, that would have to be recognized as primarily foes, not to be tolerated in a position of having any economic influence. And they go through pathogens that could be then targeted, that could then be moved from the realm of terrorism to becoming a politically useful tool. And I paraphrase very loosely, but they say that. And the outgrowth of the anthrax attacks, which we all know many, many scholarly books have been written dissecting the truth of the anthrax attacks as being an inside job. I could cite those for people. I could send links to some of these books, but that I'm fully persuaded that that was not an Al-Qaeda attack from a cave. That was something over the course of several months in 2001 that did justify the growth of the biggest monster of financing for international bioweapons facilities. The Bio Shield Act of 2004 by Cheney, and I think Victoria Nuland played a direct role in that, played a big role in growing the U.S. bioweapons operations. And I say bioweapons, but some people would say biolabs, but in Georgia, in Ukraine, all over China's perimeter, especially in South Korea, where you have the CENTOR and the other program that Obama put online in 2010, which there have been protests by South Koreans on the streets because they're very concerned that you have weaponized anthrax going from these compounds back to the Pentagon and back again with no oversight from FedEx. I mean, they're being sent in FedEx. And these things have been revealed to have been occurring. And the South Korean authorities don't even have authorization to go into these facilities, even though they're in South Korea. So, I mean, I looked at the Chinese the spokespeople at different times since the outbreak of whatever the hell this thing was launched onto the world in January 2020. And early on in February, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman was already citing works by Larry Romanov and others, pointing to the Fort Detrick, the Wuhan Games, other things, as well as the broader global bioweapons or biolabs facilities, saying, like, this is what we should be looking at. It's very opaque. Nobody's looking at it. And I think that China is aware, as is Russia, and Putin has spoken about this. There's direct speeches by Putin and Lavrov in 2017, 18, even describing their concern that a new type of attack using targeted pathogens or ethnic targeting is something that they think will be unleashed. And I am not among their inner discussions, like I said, but I know that they've been looking at that very heavily. I know that even today, the mRNA gene therapies, which have been pumped down the veins of so many people of the world, there's been a lot of pressure for 2+ years to get China to accept these gene therapies. But even today, none of the 9 different vaccines that are available within mainland China are permitted to have mRNA gene therapy manipulation. And there's a lot of pressure, like I said, that they have been put on to accept this. They said no. And they've been pushed at one point. They did have mandatory vaccinations. I think it was in June of 2021. But it lasted literally 24 hours. And instead, the decision was made to go for zero COVID instead of the mandatory vaccinations, which they immediately reversed. There's obviously stories behind the scenes that we can only infer were going on. We are not privy to a lot of these insider discussions. But that's how I'm personally looking at it right now. The U.S. the U.S. military industrial complex has built up an entire apparatus, not just around Russia, but, you know, there's 100,000 troops, 28,000 in South Korea, 50,000 in Japan. They're working Taiwan like they were working Ukraine, and they're building up a full spectrum dominance policy with the ideology that their computer models that they've been utilizing say that they could win a first strike attack on these enemies who sincerely don't want to be their enemies. I mean, I think China and Russia have made it both clear over many years that they would much rather find common ground to work with points of win-win interest with the West. They've made so many accolades and offers to join BRI projects, all of which have been met with hostility. And I think there is something going on very seriously that is not just for public theater or something, but that is a real flight forward that could lead towards a military escalation that we couldn't put back in the bottle. So that's how I'm looking at these things. I mean, China's in a war footing, though. They're not in a civilian. They see themselves as having been at war. It's been asymmetric. It's been nonlinear. But there has not been a moment in time for the past, especially 20, 30 years, where there has not been an active intention to destroy China and restore it back to its old, you know, century of humiliation serfdom. As much as Russia, I think that there's been an ongoing intention. It's taken on certain expressions, asymmetric, like I said, being the biggest one. But I think we're now moving into a new phase of this. And China and Russia they've both been on war footings with desires and offers to get out of this and to provide the West a chance to regain our senses and find something reasonable about what our better traditions used to be that they could work with. And last thing I'll just end it there is with Putin. He just said, you know, at Valdai, that he doesn't see just one West. He sees two different Wests. One is based upon principles of morality, traditional values that he can work with, and the other one is incapable of negotiation, compromise, recognizing reality, and that cannot be worked with. So I think China and Russia both see two possible a bipolar schizophrenia within the West, and they're trying to bring up or speak to the better forgotten component of the West, which even the West can't see at this point.
Anissa, can you talk about this issue of the loans and what your view is of that?
Loans, of course, are ways whether the money is so-called free. Nothing is free, and certainly the case with this interest-free loans. Some of the key components to these agreements were that significant portions of any money that's transferred to accounts in, let's say, Angola, for instance, has to be then immediately used to hire Chinese companies, construction companies, to do the lion's share of what are the projects that are often dictated also inside the contract itself when transfers of funds take place. But when loans, debt forgiveness, which also the IMF and others use this card as rewards for compliance, is certainly something that China is facing these days, as increasingly there's a unified pushback to the consequences of their relationships with. Now, again, I draw from experience directly from Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Angola. I just recently visited there. Chinese had assured a debt payment through direct sale of and transfer of raw materials. In the case of Angola, it was oil. And often they are mispriced or in very malicious ways, underpriced the oil that was being shipped out. So Angola ended up sending far more oil over the course of this period of relationship with China than was actually ever initially loaned to China. On top of the fact that the projects that never really came to fruition, or when they did, they were of such shoddy quality that a hospital, for instance, collapsed notoriously, killing the people, many people who were actually in the three-story building. It turned out that the labor force that was brought from China were prisoners. And so this made it very difficult for political parties in Angola who are struggling to secure power in the post-Dos Santos era to actually continue. And in fact, they've now decided to go directly with and opened up bids, and Portuguese and Belgian companies have bidded to take 99-year leases to actually fix up the crappy railroads that were being built towards the DRC for the copper belt that China desperately was wanting to secure access to. And in the process, China is facing actual default on these loans. And so what else can they offer other than make some kind of negotiations about this? Okay, let's continue seeing Angolan oil flow in return for debt relief, for forgiveness. And we see in the case of Laos, for instance, there will not be any debt forgiveness. And this massive project that was there in 2019 that are building railways, digging tunnels through Laos's mountains, which is an incredible feat, no doubt, but it doesn't necessarily have any positive impact on the peoples who are going to be living on both sides, or whose properties have been appropriated, or farmlands have been appropriated from this. This is a full-scale integration towards the coastal areas that will benefit China's gaining access around the Straits of Malacca that are pinch points and are very costly. They're very crowded areas. It puts huge insurance costs on shipping. Same with Bab el-Mandab and Straits of Hormuz. If you can find alternative routes for your goods and the imports, then it actually saves considerable amounts of money in the long term. So it's actually a very good investment by state finance to build this infrastructure, and in the meantime have it all paid for by these countries that you're supposedly helping build their infrastructure. That sounds to me very much like what Empire did in the using investors' funds to access raw materials in the 19th century, and which the United States and other European countries facilitated through direct sovereign access to sovereign funds in the 20th century. And again, the reason why there's debt forgiveness is because there's a lot of pushback. And this is, and many are making the calculation that the infrastructure is already there, and the raw materials that have been used to pay for these debts have balanced out any possibility of actually losing out in this equation. So I'm much more cynical in respect to China. I don't see that there's a friend, and certainly Yemenis and Congolese and Angolans today don't see an ally. And that will change the nature of this of global politics, of regional politics moving forward. It'll be interesting to see how this results. I think the collaboration between Chinese security companies that provide the kind of surveillance technology that certainly Saudi Arabia is going to benefit handsomely with, their collaboration with Israeli intelligence agencies to actually develop and expand their ability to read people's expressions and faces and, you know, preempt crime, our criminals. These are all not fantasy world. These are actually in application in many parts of the world. And it seems to me that China is on the forefront of this technology that, to me, is quite frightening. And it does not pretend to a good rosy future for the peoples of China, nor those people who have collaborated with the elites in China, especially in the Gulf. The Gulf states are on a death, on their last bit of survival anyways. And the fact that you have someone else helping, burdening the very costly, taking the burden of the heavy cost of actually keeping these corrupt regimes alive is, again, nothing to be proud of as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Issa. Vanessa, let's just end with you. What's your thoughts on what you've heard?
I think I need to go away and sort of think about it a huge amount. I like you, Mike, I probably have another 100 questions I could ask both of them.
Yeah.
Maybe at another time.
Well, I think if it can be possibly arranged, it has to happen at another time. So there has to be a follow-up to this.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, I'd like to say thank you very much to Matthew Era, to Issa Bloomey, and to Vanessa Bailey for speaking to us today. We have to end it there. I'm very sorry to say, but we will come back to this topic, I'm quite sure, in the not-too-distant future. Thanks for joining us.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thanks.